and constantly reminding the listeners, "I can't buy that," but he would just as often leap to my side when other members of panel shows would try to confuse me by cross-examination. I know the testimony of one's own father is not considered as acceptable as that given by a non-relative, but I take the liberty of doing so, in loving memory of Dad, who passed away in the early fall of 1957. Here is part of the interview, Long John, addressing my father, "Would you say these were normal-sized people?" Dad, "Oh, no. I would say one was about 6 feet two or three, and the other was about 6 feet. LJ, "Were you close enough to observe their features?" Dad, "No, that I wasn't." LJ, "Did you notice what they wore?" Dad, "To a certain extent, yes. As far as I could see, they wore something similar to ski suits, tight at the wrists and ankles, and the rest of it seemed to be, well, I just don't know how to explain it." LJ, "I think you are doing an excellent job. Don't worry about the choice of words. Everybody has a different view of things, like the three blind men who examined the elephant. You know what I mean. Each person comes out with a different story, and I don't want to be unkind, Mr. Menger. For instance, that green sport shirt you have on, somebody else might say, 'I didn't notice the green sport shirt, but I liked the striped, double-breasted suit with head on.' Everybody notices something outstanding about an individual. I think you will agree." "What kind of night was it?" Dad, "It was a dark night, but these people seemed to have a glow to them. That is how we discovered they were coming toward us, by the glow. When these people left us, the grass there, and I know positively because I had cut some of it, was 3 feet high. And they went through that grass like it was a nice concrete walk, with no exertion at all." LJ, "But afterward the next day when you examined this stretch of grass, was it matted down?" Dad, "I'm sorry, I paid no attention to that." LJ, "You have seen the ships, too, haven't you, Dad?" Dad, "Oh, yes, I have seen them in the air, and in the daytime I saw them, and at first I was very skeptical." LJ, "You are not anymore, are you?" Dad, "No, not now. And I would like to think that Dad left this earth knowing at least a portion of the truth." 18. The police. One night as we sat at the table having a last cup of coffee and snack before retiring, a knock came at the door. We opened it and four men entered. Three of them said they were detectives from a nearby state police barracks, the fourth was a newspaper reporter. They assured us they were on unofficial business, that it was merely a social call. They had heard some of the stories already circulating, were intensely curious, asked to hear of my experiences firsthand. Barring the fact they called at a late hour and were obvious in their intents, I patiently went through the story of my contacts, the sightings and the witnesses. They asked to see the pictures and I had to tell them they were not available at the moment. That made them even more skeptical. The pictures had been loaned to a friend, so I offered to go and get them. After telephoning my friend and learning the family was still up, I got into the car and left. On the way to Wood Glen, where my friend lived, I heard a voice speaking my name over the car radio, "Howard, show your friends the pictures, and after that we suggest you show them a location number 2, for there will be a ship in the area and a 3-foot disc on the ground approximately 100 yards from the entrance to the field. Three men will be there to greet you. We suggest your friends bring no flashlights, nor weapons of any kind." The voice was gone and the music, interrupted by the message, came on again in full volume. At that time I did not recognize the voice, later I would meet its owner in California. When I returned, I showed the men the pictures, and although they expressed much interest, I could sense their skepticism, though they tried to hold it politely in reserve. I asked them if they would like to see something at one of the contact points, and had never seen anyone look so eager as they did. I asked that they leave their guns on the table or in their cars, and that they not bring flashlights. They assured me they were not armed. We went up to location number 2, and just as we entered the field, I saw a pulsating glow ahead of us, and I made out the faint outline of a craft above the trees. We stopped and got out of the car. Two of the men admitted seeing the glow, but not the outline of the ship. I asked them to wait by the car while I went ahead to see if it were all right for them to come ahead. I greeted one of the space visitors who was waiting for me. Farther down in the field I could see two others, and near them an observation disc on the ground. The man I greeted was dressed in Earth clothing, leather jacket and trousers, and his hair was trimmed in our style. Suddenly the disc on the ground changed from a bluish-white to a reddish-orange color and I knew what it indicated. I wondered if it were I who created the negative reaction. The man answered, "No, it is the gentleman by the car, and it is because of his ignorance and fear of the unknown. We are sorry we cannot invite your friends to come any closer, for there is a weapon present, and one of the men would attempt to use it without hesitation." I was discouraged. The men had lied when they said they had no weapons. I thanked the visitors and walked back to the waiting men. I told them the disc was there, but advised them not to go any closer. They complied and smiled knowingly at each other, and I could tell they didn't believe me. I filled my pipe, but when I reached into my pocket to get my lighter, discovered I had left it at home. Remembering a spare in the glove compartment, I reached in to get it, and, as I did so, picked up the thoughts of one of the men. He thought the glow they had seen had been caused by my lighter and that I had only pretended to have left my lighter in the car. They thought I had perpetrated a hoax. Many of the witnesses were interrogated by various civilian investigators who showed a desire to prove or disprove my story. The best investigation was carried out by Jules Street Germain, an attorney from Lynbrook, Long Island. His intelligent and fair approach to the entire matter was respected by witnesses and myself. Even though hundreds of people besieged our house, Street Germain managed to take the witnesses aside and tape record their versions of the story. The best tape, in my opinion, was the account given by the physicist. The witness patiently talked into Street Germain's microphone for 2 solid hours, and gave a completely unbiased account. One night as Street Germain, Lee Munsick and another man were leaving my place, they said they were going up to location number 1 before they left for home, hoping they would see something. I smiled, for I knew that my space friends were making themselves and their craft obvious for as many witnesses as possible during this particular phase of my story and felt they might actually see something which would lessen their skepticism. "You will be back," I told them as they left. 30 minutes later we heard them again at the door. Two of them looked perplexed, the face of the other was white. Something had happened up there, but I found it impossible to draw anything from them. It is difficult for people to absorb what they do not understand. It is often easier simply not to believe than to accept. Many strange things, involving actual contacts with beings from other worlds, have happened. Often these have seemed inexplicable and overly mysterious to some people. They have often been definitely alien to our concepts. I have made many errors in presenting this story and in accomplishing some of my missions. I have made marginal errors, over an underestimation of people, situations and experiments. Many times I have been bewildered in ascertaining the correct way to handle circumstances, and to many of my friends I have thus appeared confused. I was trying to do a gargantuan job with feeble tools. However, I have never given up hope or faith, and the pattern of my life is now assuming a more stable atmosphere, which, in the future, will be conducive to more constructive work. Higher civilizations can actually destroy a lesser one without intent, by imposing their higher wisdom on those who cannot understand or absorb it. The space people realize this danger, and they are exercising great care in the manner of going about our education. When the white man came to the Indians, and when missionaries went to the natives, they superimposed their concepts and methods on less advanced civilizations. Many times the results were disastrous. The space people have perfected many machines, instruments to aid in better living, gifts of awareness, which would be of tremendous benefit to our humanity. But if they gave these to us abruptly, without preparing us gradually to use them, these gifts might bring disaster instead of blessings. Too many people, for example, who, after receiving gifts of awareness and develop certain God-given powers, such as extrasensory perception, astral projection, teleportation, and so on, use these powers to further their own selfish desires, to gain control and influence over their brothers on this planet, instead of helping them to help themselves. I personally know several who have developed certain of these talents and have then used them for curious experimentation and for impressing people with their unusual powers. Such powers, unless used only when necessary, and only for helping others, will be taken away as quickly as they were given, or they will be gradually dissipated over a period of time with serious ill effects. I most urgently and humbly implore my brothers who are gifted with certain powers to use them sparingly and only in the name of our Infinite Father. In my own early experiences with these gifts I, too, made mistakes, but I am thankful that I have now realized the correct manner in which they should be used. 19. The Phantom Car. Many investigators came to check my story and question my witnesses. When I learned that a certain man was to give me a going over, I was certain of one thing: although I would be gone over with a fine-toothed comb, I would be investigated fairly. That man was John Otto, one of the best-known civilian researchers in the flying saucer field. His initial skepticism, I can happily report, ended with sponsoring me at a lecture in his hometown, Chicago, Illinois. I think it best simply to quote Otto's introductory talk verbatim, for it describes his investigation better than ever I could, in his own inimitable way which has made him such a popular lecturer. Now we come to the part of the story many of you have asked about, just how I happened to be sponsoring Mr. Howard Menger. Let me start by explaining how I happened to meet him. I had just finished trying to stabilize one of the fraudulent stories on the West Coast. I had been requested to go there and check this thing which turned out to have been a prank originally, which someone had whipped up and amplified into a terrific fraud. In order to keep my nose clean in the field of research, I had to dig up the facts, though I did not like the job, for I do not like to look for untruths, but to look for the truth. However, one of the best science editors in the newspaper field had asked me to do it, and I couldn't turn him down. Shortly thereafter a telephone call came through from New York City: "Please, Mr. Otto, come out here and apply your investigative technique and your knowledge gained from 9 years of research in the field, and expose another one." I did not want anything to do with it, and I thought, this time I have had it, and I am ready to quit. If I have to run around the country and prove this man valid and that man a crook, I want no part of this subject. Finally, they said they had to have somebody come there and do something about it, and they would pay my plane fare. So I thought it over, then a business trip worked in whereby I could pay some of my other expenses I would incur. So the short of it is that I went east to investigate one Howard Menger, and I got a jolt. A severe jolt. When I got into New Jersey, I spoke with Howard Menger and still could not believe it. He could not show me evidence I could consider conclusive, and if I am easy to, shall we say, show evidence to than a lot of people, I have been in this a long while, and I know some of the truths in it. A short while after this I had to make a broadcast on the Long John all-night radio show. On this show several members of an East Coast investigative organization were already damning this man Menger without any investigation at all, merely on the grounds that the man had claimed he had met interplanetary visitors. It was awfully hard, it was a difficult situation. They asked me what he thought of Mr. Menger, and I had to tell them honestly that it was too short a period of time in which to accept or reject a story of that nature. 2 days later I was requested to try another contact attempt, such as Otto had successfully carried out over Chicago's WGN, HM, in a broadcast over a 50,000-watt station. At about 4 o'clock in the morning of January 10, 1957, we again tried to establish a communication contact that changed the whole script suddenly. I decided at this moment, that if the boys wanted to come through and help, then they could help this way. Let's have an endorsement of Howard Menger. Endorse him, or reject him, whichever the case might be. And rather astoundingly, I received an endorsement of Howard Menger. Not conclusive, but enough to turn me overnight into a supporter of this man, who, a few moments before, I thought was a fraud. Everybody at the station received a shock. The next night Long John received a telegram from me stating, I may have evidence that may validate Howard Menger. Then I went back on the air, but was not in accord with submitting the evidence. I didn't want to. I thought it best to keep this evidence back at their time, but I was forced into submitting it and, with Howard Menger's permission, we submitted that evidence over the air, but not all of it, just a minute part of it, the kind of thing we as Earth people must always look for. A little bit of truth, a little bit of evidence that we need to go along with this thing. Now I want to ask you all, right now, not to plunge into acceptance of everything in the flying saucer subject. Examine it carefully. Evaluate it just as we have done, and then, when each and every one of you are ready, believe me, you will have your OWN proof, all the proof you want. The end of this section about my witnesses would hardly be complete without my relating one rather humorous incident. Our group, of about 40 people, met every Thursday night at the home of Twoof the members, a charming young couple of Pluck Emin, N.J., who graciously donated their recreation room for our meetings. At these gatherings I usually talked about my experiences, but my main purpose was to present spiritual concepts as taught by the space people. My job in conjunction with the Space Brothers was to awaken within each member a desire for learning more about the universe and its true meaning, our purposes on the Earth, where we came from, and where we are going. While it was an exhilarating mental pursuit, some minds were able to absorb it, but some were not. It was religious, but only in the sense that we tried to present the theme that God is omnipresent, omnipotent and omniscient. Out of this small test group the Space Brothers and I hoped to produce teachers who would teach others who, in turn, would teach still others. The meetings usually began about 8 p.m. and lasted until midnight. After the lesson, you would have a coffee break and then a general social get-together before leaving. One night in the spring of 1957, during a coffee break in the discussions, I mentally broke away from the group to relax. My thoughts took me back to the old 1950 light green station wagon I had traded in a few days before in Philadelphia for a new 1957 station wagon. I sentimentally thought of the old jalopy and the many wonderful experiences I had while owning it. In my mind's eye I drove it along on a blacktop road, picturing many things in vivid detail. Then I left the reverie, returned mentally to the group, and becoming aware of the discussion, joined in, without giving another thought to my vivid mental experience. We left the house about 12:30 a.m. At the next meeting the telephone rang about midnight and the host answered it. I was surprised to learn the call was for me from the police station in Bedminster Township, a few miles from Pluck Emin. I picked up the phone. Are you Howard Menger? Yes. We have a summons down here for you. Would you please come down and pick it up? Sergeant Kramer claims you were speeding and went through a red light in his district about 11:40 p.m. on, he named the date of the last meeting. Checking the date and time with the group, I said, it couldn't have been me, because I was here at that time and there were at least 20 people here with me. Besides, I do not have a 1950 station wagon, sir, I have a 1957 Plymouth station wagon, and incidentally, it could not have left the premises because it was blocked in by other cars, and I had the keys in my pocket. The voice insisted I come down and pick up the summons and appear in court to answer charges, else pay the $15 fine. I did not go that night, but after thinking about it, I realized what had happened. I had been thinking about my old station wagon and had been driving it mentally the night of the last meeting, at the exact time mentioned by Sergeant Kramer. Could it have been possible that my thoughts had manifested into an actual projection? They finally sent the summons through Police Chief Kais at High Bridge, who delivered it personally to my home. I decided to appear in court and took along 7 witnesses. The charges were presented, then several witnesses testified, and finally I was called to the stand. I pleaded not guilty to the charges. I said I was not there at the time and had witnesses to prove it. Furthermore, I did not have occasion to drive through that section when going to and from my friend's house. Sergeant Kramer's testimony went something like this. He saw a light green station wagon with license plates WRE79 speed past him. When the car reached the red light at the intersection, it went right through without stopping. He said he pursued the car to the red light where it disappeared. His using the word disappeared intrigued me. The roads stretch out straight for long distances through the country in each direction from the intersection, so it was likely that tail lights from such a speeding car would have still been visible. He was asked if he saw a driver, but he said he did not, and reiterated the station wagon had just disappeared at the intersection. When the judge heard that, he remarked, "Well, what do we have around here? A phantom car." A tenseness came over the entire room. I realized Sergeant Kramer was not lying. He had seen my old car, and I felt sorry for him. The judge said, "I feel like either putting a man in jail for perjury or breaking a sergeant." I was finally recalled to the stand and still affirmed I was not guilty. Finally, the testimony of the witnesses and fact I no longer owned the station wagon gave the judge no other alternative but to arrive at the decision of not guilty. Incidentally, we had checked with the auto agency in Philadelphia where I had traded in my old station wagon and learned it was still in the shop being repaired for resale. The judge aptly summed up the case with, "This is the strangest case I have heard in all my years on the bench." 20. The Song from Saturn. Although by the fall of 1956 I had become accustomed to encountering the unusual everywhere I turned, an old cabin in the woods, secluded and obscure, was the center of one of my most bizarre experiences. As I stood there, hesitating to walk up to it, I knew it was the only building for miles around. And I knew something had drawn me there, because a few minutes previously, I had suddenly lost control of my car, and realized it was being driven for me by some higher intelligence. This new experience was indeed unique, and it opened to me a whole new world of creative expression, one I had no talent for, or thought I hadn't. Considering the work of the space people, however, I should not have considered it unique, for I had found that continual contact with my friends from outer worlds have seemed to trigger in my consciousness many hidden talents and gifts of which I had been completely unaware. The car, whatever was controlling it, had led me off the main road, and I had ridden for miles through the countryside on little used roads, not knowing just where I was. When the car came to a stop, I looked off through the woods, and there to my left was the old cabin, dilapidated and apparently unused for years. Whomever or whatever was in the cabin, I knew I had been brought there and that I must enter the old dwelling. I walked nearer. Very low at first, and then louder, the strains of the most inspiring, soul-tingling music ever to fall upon my ears emanated from their cabin. I paused outside the door, stood there entranced, letting the music flow through me. I seemed to be absorbing the music into my entire body, and my heart almost beat in time to its pulsating rhythm. The music seemed to soothe and excite me at the same time. Yet I found the bewilderment developing within me, something that disturbed me deeply. What was it? Then I knew the reason. Somehow the music was familiar, but only vaguely so. Had I heard it somewhere, on the radio, on a television show, in the movies? Certainly not this kind of music. Once I had stood suddenly in a great auditorium when an entire audience had risen to its feet as a great conductor, now passed on, waved his baton and brought wild crescendos thundering from the brass and percussion sections of the great orchestra. Under his superb direction we heard sounds and emotions never before wrung from the heart of musicians. And some of us had wept. But this music was not a wild crescendo of sounds, nor a heady emotionalism coaxed from strings. It was a simple melody, apparently played on one instrument. I pushed timidly on the door, partly ajar. At my touch it swung open, and there, sitting at a piano-like instrument in the middle of the main room was a man, playing the unusual melody. Little about the man appeared strange. He wore a rough woolen shirt, just as any camper might wear, and trousers tucked into heavy boots. He was ordinary enough, excepting, perhaps, for his long brown hair, which curled under and fell to his shoulders, reminding me of pictures of page boys. His skin was smooth and white, and his eyes, which I first saw when he looked at me and smiled, were hazel. His entire demeanor was one of serenity mixed with good humor. My eyes went from the man to the surroundings. The floor of the rustic cabin was wood, partly covered by a rug. At one end was a huge fireplace, and at the other end I saw a series of instruments which I realized certainly didn't originate on Earth. From the instruments my eyes went to the wall on which I saw a clock, but a most unusual timepiece. Instead of numbers I saw 12 fluorescent spheres, nor were the hands on the clock. Instead I noticed a very bright light on the face of the clock where the hour hand should be. I glanced at my watch, which said 4:10, then back at the clock and noted the bright light appeared very near the fourth sphere. Where the minute hand should be I saw another light, of lesser intensity. On the floor were more instruments, one of them a box-like instrument with a view screen, something like a portable television set. Another instrument was shaped similar to a console set, with a coil-like aerial revolving on top of it. Just then two blonde-headed men stepped from another room, as one of them greeted me, "Hi, Howard, we have been expecting you." Then he introduced the other blonde man and told me both of them were aliens from outside our star system. "And our own private Liberace here," as the pianist scowled at them, then grinned, "is from one of their planets." The gentleman broke off playing with a good-natured, theatrical flourish on the keys, rose and extended his hand. I complimented him on his playing, and told him the music sounded familiar. Then I halted in the middle of a sentence, for I remembered where I had heard the melody. Why, it was the little tune I had so often hummed, and even tried to pick out, unsuccessfully, on the piano. I had never given the melody much thought. "Sit down and play it, the melody," he offered, gesturing toward the instrument, but I stammered the only thing I could play was a phonograph. He put his hand on my shoulder and spoke reassuringly. "This music you can play, Howard," and he guided me gently toward the chair in front of the piano. I sat, protestingly. "From this time on you will be able to play a piano whenever you are moved to do so, and not only this tune, but any melody you wish." I looked down at the keyboard. It was entirely different from a conventional piano keyboard. This one was much longer and contained many more keys, which were narrower and had strange symbols on them which I did not understand. The entire instrument was much lower and closer to the floor. I almost automatically reached down to touch the keys, suddenly knowing which to strike to correspond with the sounds of the melody running through me mind. Although I had never been able to play before, it all seemed natural and delightfully simple. Although I could not master the subtle nuances I had heard in his playing, I believe I could have played it otherwise as perfectly as he, had my fingers not often struck two of the keys instead of the intended one, probably because of the narrowness. As I played, the men looked at each other and nodded, then they applauded politely when I finished. I was thrilled and happy, because I knew I had suddenly found a beautiful, haunting melody that had always stirred my imagination, and found myself playing a musical instrument for the first time. The alien friend from another world spoke. You're wondering why we brought you here for a musical exercise, and it probably seems foolish to you. But it isn't. You're going to play this melody on the piano, Howard, and thousands of people of Earth will hear it. I visited with them all that night, which we spent talking of many things which would be taking place in the months to follow.